Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is James Patterson, the 2014-15 Thomas W. Smith Postdoctoral Research Associate at the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions, affiliated with Princeton University. You know that is a very impressive academic appointment because of the very lengthy title associated with it. For those of you not in the know on these things, academic titles are increasing at a faster pace than the rising cost of college education. Dr. Patterson is a graduate of the University of Houston, home of the Fighting Cougars, who recently staged one of the most dramatic comebacks in college football history. Although not playing on that team, James graduated from that fine institution and went on to earn his PhD at the Department of Politics at the University of Virginia back in 2012. He has also served as a visiting fellow in the Program of American Values and Institutions at Duke University and as a visiting assistant professor of government and foreign affairs at Hampton Sydney College. He has a forthcoming article in the Journal of Church and State entitled The American Nehemiah, or A Tale of Two Walls. And he is currently finishing a book manuscript dealing with the media strategies of Martin Luther King Jr., Fulton Sheen, and Jerry Falwell, which will be the topic of today's discussion. James, welcome to Research on Religion.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I've been really looking forward to this. I cannot sympathize enough with the length of that title, since I have to fill it out on forms. I'm always afraid I'm going to get the words wrong.
And do you have to put that on a business card? I mean, because that would be, you'd have to get a 3x5 business card instead of one of the standard ones, or you'd have to create some kind of acronym.
Suitcase behind me to carry them in.
Yeah, or you create some kind of acronym and it becomes really lengthy and people go, wow, what is that? Yeah, these academic titles, they're getting longer, but that's good because you're a well-deserving scholar of that honor out there at Princeton University, and I had the opportunity to meet you last fall and discuss some of your work. And the stuff that really interests me, and we're coming up as well on Martin Luther King Day here, you're writing a book manuscript with the working title of Priest, Prophet, and King, Religious Foundations and Public Policy During the American 20th Century. Part of that book deals with Martin Luther King Jr., as well as a few other folks. And this is a reworking of your dissertation. And before we plunge into the book, give me an idea about the genesis of this project. I mean, most folks, including graduate students, don't really know where dissertation ideas come from. So give us some history of this idea and provide a little bit of advice for young graduate students out there in finding a topic.
So when I was trying to come up with something, I was in the stage that, I'm not sure if this is used anywhere else, but at UVA we called it topicking stage. And it's the 30 days in the wilderness where you've read a lot, you know, you've passed your comps, you're getting your stuff together, and you don't know how to narrow down a topic. And what I discovered is that if you've got an advisor, just pick something that they wanted to do but can't get around to doing. And so Jim Caesar at UVA had just published a book. He was my advisor on nature and history in American political development. But he threw in the book an additional topic beyond nature and history, and that was religion. And the design of the book actually had criticism of his topic in the actual text, and everyone criticized him for not doing religion enough. So I just kind of raised my hand and said, I'll do it. And Jim said, well, go to it. And so I've gotten this far.
Okay, so, but did you have any kind of previous interest in religion or politics, or was this completely opportunistic? I mean, if he would have given you the politics of nuclear submarines in the Antarctic, you know, would you have, oh yeah, I'll do that too, love that topic? Or were you somehow pump primed to, you know, be studying these histories of ideas and then the way that people propagate them out there?
Okay, maybe I was being a little too cute. Okay. I actually have a very strong interest in this beforehand and was chomping at the bit to go after a topic. I just didn't know how to do it, until I had read that and the sequel to it that came out. There was a book that came out afterwards on the Tesla Lectures on Christianity, American Democracy, and I kind of wanted to explain how the two are actually a little separated. And to do that, I decided to kind of shift into American political development by going after, at least in the dissertation originally, go after kind of the what I thought were the weaknesses in the methods used by James Moroney and Andrew Murphy by collecting everything into the Jeremiad, and instead focusing on individual thinkers that seem to veer away from being so easily categorized in the American Jeremiah.
Now, you used a very interesting term there, and I'm not very good with multisyllabic words, such as Jeremiad. What is Jeremiad? Right.
So that is an entirely different podcast. No, but the Jeremiah briefly, and when it's briefly, it's always a little unfair, is the narrative that the nation faces decline because of some kind of sin, whether it be social, because we're not assisting the poor in our public policy, or because of some sort of personal sin, because we are, for instance, you know, engaging in high divorce rates, and that God will bring his judgment on us in history, right? So this is the classic story from the Bible, Jeremiah, that this is the reason why Israel is facing decline and eventually exile, because God's withdrawing his support from the nation. And there are most figures in American political history that are sort of religious variety, they use the Jeremiah, but that's not the sufficient account for how major thinkers have tried to make an impact on public policy.
Wait, you said it is or is not the way that...
It's not.
It is not.
Mm-mm.
Okay, all right. But nonetheless, it comes up in history quite a bit. It's embedded in a lot of popular movements, such as various Great Awakenings and such.
Right.
So it'll be interesting to see how you weave this in here into your thoughts and dissertations. So let's dig into the book. And again, the working title of it is Priest, Prophet, and King, Religious Foundations and Public Policy During the American 20th Century. I should emphasize that's a working title. The publishers always have the opportunity to go ahead and change that. But it is an interesting title, and I would keep it if I was a publisher. So break this down for us a little bit, starting with the main title, Priest, Prophet, and King. What does that refer to?
Those are the three offices of baptism. They refer specifically to the offices perfected in the person of Jesus, and through baptism, Christians receive grace that places them in that same office. So every believer is required by baptism to be a priest, prophet, and king in their own individual capacity. They minister to others, they bear witness to salvation to others, and that they govern themselves according to the demands of Christian discipline. And it's a little bit of a play here because this is precisely what each of the figures studied in the book manuscript do, but they have to do so within the confines of what's acceptable in American liberal politics. So it's a bit of a navigation for each of them.
That is really interesting. I was wondering if you're also playing on, you know, Martin Luther King and King and Priest. We typically think of Catholic, and you have Fulton Sheen there.
Right.
No intention on that?
You caught me again. That's right. It's also supposed to be a bit of a wink in the title. But what you're also supposed to sort of think about by the end of the book is how each of them actually, you know, despite only one of them being a Catholic priest and only one of them being named King, they actually, in the end, operate according to each of those offices as well. But it's also supposed to be a little bit of humor.
Yeah, and I like that title, right? It winds it around, and by the end of the book, you are thinking about, okay, why did this guy name the title that? And it's a very clever title. So any publishers out there, keep the title. It is actually very good. You also mentioned just a minute ago that these three figures, Martin Luther King, Fulton Sheen, and Jerry Falwell, are operating in American liberal politics. Now, that term liberal in contemporary lingo has a very different connotation than I think you're meaning it, because I think a lot of people would say Jerry Falwell, you know, liberal or something. What do you mean by liberal here?
I think Falwell would actually sort of instinctively have seized at the term. But I just mean an emphasis on individual rights, you know, in some cases limited government, at least in the case of establishing a religion, and the consent of the governed sort of being the operating principle for what legitimates governing, and jury trials, you know, all of these sort of inherited traditions from England that were then sort of tweaked by the founders or radically overhauled, depending on who you ask. And so I don't mean any kind of ideological kind of meaning there.
No. Yeah, so it's the old democratic capitalist type of ideal that was in the English Enlightenment or Scottish Enlightenment and then the 1700s and 1800s, right?
Precisely, yeah.
So you got these three guys. You got Martin Luther King, and a lot of people write about him and very interested in him. And again, we're right on the cusp here of Martin Luther King Day, so a lot of discussion about him. But you throw in there Fulton Sheen, a Catholic bishop, and Jerry Falwell. You think about these folks as being, at least Falwell and King as being polar opposites, and Sheen is, you know, kind of in the mix there as well. So why did you choose these three individuals?
So what holds the three together is that each of them was a public figure that gave a religious foundation to American politics and then used mass media as a way of engaging in public persuasion on behalf of that foundation. And this is incredibly important. It's the central position that I take, that each of these figures, they don't necessarily agree on much, certainly not, but that they do operate in the same way in politics in order to promote a policy agenda and to make it the agenda of the people. They also operate not just engaging in mass politics through media where they try to persuade constituents of, you know, people across the country, but they also engage in direct elite appeals as well. You know, King famously called upon John F. Kennedy, and after his assassination, LBJ to pass bills to support civil and voting rights. And Falwell was a big supporter of Reagan, and Bishop Sheen actually a favorite guest. Washington's favorite, but he was frequently at the Eisenhower White House, so they engaged in two sides of a sort of political appeal. So that's what the three of them have in common.
Now, there's a possibility of other people that you could have considered here. Francis Schaeffer was a popular writer, really trying to get into people's faces and change ideas. Billy Graham, quite obviously, is one of the great proselytizers of the 20th century. Richard John Neuhouse could also come to mind as well. Why did you pick those three and not those three? Is there any kind of particular reason again?
There are two big reasons. One is the project can't encompass all of them, right? One of the advantages to the traditional approach to religion in American political development is that you can establish categories like the Jeremiad and then fit figures within them in order to show the broad sweep of a way of thinking about politics that religion traditionally has. If you use my approach, then sadly you have to kind of like work at each individual one in order to illustrate how they've impacted politics. But that's a kind of limitation in terms of page length. That's not the big reason. The big reason is also a figure like Francis Schaeffer. He did have a kind of appeal within a certain segment, but he didn't engage in the kind of mass-scale politics and elite lobbying that someone like Falwell did. Graham was more closely affiliated with presidents in the past, especially, Richard Nixon, but kind of shied away from making direct political appeals. He did have integrated services and wasn't a big fan of communism, but shied away from getting too politically active, especially when you think about, the march across the Selma. You know, Billy Graham wasn't quite doing things like that. And someone like Neuhouse is much more of a sort of an elite intellectual thinker who's influencing people by diffusing his ideas into the public square, and not so much engaging in mass political appeals and trying to directly influence political thinking, at least on the scale of these three figures. So it's not that they don't do any of these things, it's that they don't do them enough in order to merit being included over Fulton Sheen, King, or Falwell.
And there's always that dissertation advice, too, that there's two types of dissertation, finished and unfinished. And so you want the finished kind, and so don't take on every possible thing there. And, you know, the other thing is you leave yourself open for volume two with Francis Schaeffer, Billy Graham, and Richard John Newhouse. So
that's right. And there's a lot to be said. I mean, I'm saying what I'm saying about Billy Graham, and I'm knowing that some people are going to object to it. I'm kind of seizing a little when I say it, because there's a lot to say about the politics of not engaging in direct appeal. But that is, like you said, volume two, which is coming to a store near you in 2017, I'm sure.
Yeah, no, that actually, the whole of, you know, to create that type of research project. Here's people who do engage mass politics. Here's people who do not. I mean, that's a great, I would write book two. I advise you to do that. You're still young in your career. And so, you have an agenda out there now. The other question I have to ask, and this is one that I'm somewhat sensitive to, and we had John Owen on last week and making some strange comparisons. We call these apples and oranges comparisons. And, you know, I compare apples and oranges all the time at the grocery store. So I love strange comparisons, but a lot of people don't. And I am sure that when people were looking at your dissertation and you were talking at conferences and around the country about this stuff, they probably gave you a lot of pushback on including Martin Luther King and Jerry Falwell in the same book. I mean, have you received a lot of pushback?
Yeah, when I mention Fulton Sheen, I get a lot of blank stares. Except from the older folks, remember him from being on television. But when I put King and Falwell together, people immediately assume that there's some sort of agenda here, either to lower King or to raise Falwell. But the agenda merely is just to explain how sort of popular religious figures that want to engage in policy advocacy do so with both the mass media strategy and an elite appeal strategy. So it's not so much that I have an agenda for one figure or another. If anything, the agenda here is to bring Fulton Sheen into discussion, because he very frequently gets overlooked, but his impact is actually a little bit more serious than I think gets credit, and it's partly because he was not viewed as political, as someone like King obviously was, and certainly someone as Falwell. But that's not so much a sort of ideological agenda for one thing or another, as much as it's just sort of a research agenda to get Fulton Sheen back into discussion.
And it is a great comparison, too, to take people that you wouldn't assume to be in the same room and say, listen, there's a lot of similarities. They could be in the same room on a number of different dimensions here. And so let's go ahead and look at that. And that's what we will do, because the next thing that jumps out from the title of your book, and you mentioned this a little bit earlier, is foundations, political foundations and religious foundations. The religious foundation is actually right there in the subtitle of your book. And I have a kind of sense of what a foundation is. It's that cement thing underneath my house that keeps everything level. But, you know, religious foundations, political foundations, what do we mean by that?
It's actually not a bad place to start. Political foundations, at least in the way that I understand politics to work in the United States, are simply the values around which people base the policy preferences and institutional sort of structures that they want for the nation. And they don't necessarily have to be religious. As I said before, you know, the person who kind of lit the fire for me to write this project was my advisor, Jim Caesar, and he talks about how the former English colonists, now free Americans, had to find a way of grounding their understanding of the rights of Englishmen. And John Adams made appeals to nature, and so suddenly natural rights became the basis rather than the traditional rights affiliated with the people or nation. Also, notions of progress are grounded in history that we are achieving over time through conflict, or even through self-improvement, a capacity to govern ourselves and to engage in free trade. That sort of look to the future is sort of understanding the history as prelude to a greater time, or sort of kingdom. And religious foundations, it's an appeal somehow to the divine as an authority both for the legitimacy of the regime and also the specific policy preferences or agenda that the different leaders have. And in this case, each of them is one denomination or another a Christian, and so they often invoke sort of Christian understandings of religion, but never denominationally so strict, because they have to make a mass appeal.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how political foundations operate. It's the ground, the way that people understand their nation and the policies that they see specifically important to the nation at the moment.
Now, let me raise a common objection to religion in politics here in the United States that I oftentimes hear, is that, you know, the America was founded on the separation of church and state. And people look back at the First Amendment and say, see, that's, you know, keep religion out of politics here. To what extent do religious foundations really play an important part in our history? I mean, are we a secular nation where we just disregard these religious political foundations, or do they crop up all the time, and why?
So that's a great clarifying point. I was wondering if I had gotten this across. I argue that these figures present and try to persuade the public of religious foundations. It's not so much an argument that I'm trying to make that the nation is founded on some kind of Christian identity or some kind of denominational affiliation specifically. So what often these foundational ideas are doing are contesting each other in public. And each of these figures actually has to confront a lot of critics that make these exact charges. One of the big ones, of course, is Falwell, who runs specifically into the question you've asked, that there's the separation of church and state, isn't he trying to create a theocracy? And so they actually have to find a way of squaring their claims about the importance of Christianity or specific religious beliefs that they want people to have at minimum with the liberal order in which the Americans operate. So they have to, that squaring is actually what's normally embedded in the mass appeal they make. They try to find some way of including everyone, even if they're not even specifically religious. So it's built into the message, even if they're making something that sounds like it's violating the separation of church and state.
And that is rather interesting, too, because not only do we have a quote-unquote secular state that is not going to be a theocracy from the underpinning document of the Constitution, but on top of this, you have a multi-denominational nation. You have Catholics, right. You have Protestants, every flavor of Protestants, Jews, Muslims, et cetera, et cetera. So we're a big melting pot. So one has to probably understand that the appeal has to be made more broadly.
Right. And each of these figures appeals to the same concept. That's called the Judeo-Christian heritage, although King actually refers to it as the Hebraic Christian heritage. There's a really great book on this called The Rise of Liberal Religion by Matt Hedstrom. He's actually a religious studies professor at the University of Virginia. He talks about the rise of this sort of ecumenicism at the beginning of the 20th century by mainline Protestants to bring in these figures so that they can find some kind of common ground. This sort of middle brow effort to include a lot of their friends and neighbors that previously they had to be sort of denominationally distinct from. So a lot of these figures are just kind of picking up on this effort, especially once the mainline Protestant churches began to experience decline. The way that figures who wanted to use religion as a way of grouping constituents together, like King and Falwell and Sheen, did so was with this category of Judeo-Christian heritage. I'm not saying that it's necessarily like the right thing or the true thing. In fact, what's funny about it is we often treat it as an old idea. But it's actually only 80 years old. There are people older than this idea. Maybe not 80, but like a 90.
It is interesting when you think about the selection of the people you examine in your book. With Martin Luther King Jr., and you think about the civil rights movement, there's lots of pictures of him marching with Jewish rabbis and Catholic
right.
priests, so it does seem very multi-denominational. But for somebody like Fulton Sheen, he mm-hmm. is working pretty much at the middle part of the 20th century. He lives a pretty long, healthy life for most of the 20th century, but a lot of his radio and television is occurring in the 40s and 50s and into the 60s. And he's a Catholic. And we all remember, you know, John F. Kennedy running, and he is a Catholic, and that's going to be a big issue here. If he's trying to build a broad mass appeal, that's going to be pretty difficult for him to do as a Catholic at that point in our history.
And he got his career started in the 1930s, which was not a, you know, a great experience for a lot of Catholics. He was actually very good friends with Al Smith. That was one of the first people who kind of got him into the taste for politics. And because he was in with Al Smith in New York, he was sort of viewed with a certain amount of skepticism by Protestant leaders in the state, especially in the city. Who kind of feared the Irish Catholic, who comes in and is very charismatic, because Bishop Sheen is very charismatic, and might threaten liberty at home. So Sheen has a way of dealing with that. This is just an aside. I may be the only person I know who ever used TiVo as a research device, but one of the easiest ways for me to get a hold of episodes of Fulton Sheen's Life is Worth Living was just to TiVo it on the Eternal Word television network, I think, EWTN. Uh-huh. And they would always open it up with a line from his 1948 work, Communism and the Conscience of the West, which ends, "We cannot meet together in church, but we can meet on our knees in prayer." That's how I paraphrase it. So that was his sort of denominational outreach he had engaged in.
And the same thing, too, and I might be jumping the gun a little bit here because we're going to talk about Falwell a little bit later, but Falwell, too, has to make this kind of broad appeal. But I think of your three cases that you select here, many people would argue that Falwell's appeal was a little bit too narrow to evangelicals. Did he consciously have an idea of, okay, let's broaden it to non-denominational, let's embrace the Catholics and the United Methodists, etc.?
Falwell, you know, this is one of the funny things about Falwell. We think about him as being very narrowly religious, but if you look at it from the perspective of Falwell, he was engaging in all sorts of taboos. First thing he did was he was actually engaging in politics, which for many separatist fundamentalists in the South and Midwest was just out of the question. The world was coming to an end. The United States was corrupt. And what we needed to do was prepare ourselves for the coming end. So Bob Jones, who was a fellow pastor here, was just absolutely loathed Falwell as a liberal, and that sort of strikes people as strange. But you know, I mean, Falwell, first he starts to engage in politics. Next thing you know, he's actually speaking on good terms with people outside of his church. And by that, I don't necessarily mean like Catholic priests. I mean like evangelical Protestants. Like, that was too far for a lot of people within his church. So for Falwell, he was actually very ecumenical. It was a little easier for people like King and Sheen because they were already in that milieu. I mean, King went to Boston University and was surrounded by people of different religious denominations and educated in multiple traditions. And, Sheen, like we already mentioned, was sort of engaging in back and forth with Protestant leaders in New York City. But Falwell had his own, strange version of ecumenicism to reckon with before he became a real national figure.
Well, we'll come back to that in a second. I want to break down each of these individuals by themselves and give a little bit of deeper history about their political and religious foundations as well. And we could do it chronologically. We could start with Fulton Sheen and then move to Martin Luther King, but we again are looking at Martin Luther King Day here. So let's go ahead and start with that one. And it's probably of those three figures, he is probably the best known. So let's start with King. What was Martin Luther King's political foundations and what made it religious?
So in the book manuscript, I refer to what King's doing as what's called a progressive covenant. Progressive covenant just means that he understands that by moral improvement and institutional improvement, Americans, and really the whole world, but especially Americans, his primary audience, could come ever closer to achieving the kingdom of God on earth. This is what's called post-millennial eschatology. He was not specific about what made him think this, because, again, he wasn't so much of an elite thinker who was trying to gain some sort of theological sense here, as much as he was trying to sort of ground American policy preferences. So he wasn't totally specific on what that was, but one thing he was always emphasizing on how to achieve that end, the kingdom of God on earth, was through love. And he was always at pains to explain about what love was. He has a set piece that he uses in multiple versions of articles he wrote, that love is not philia, right? It's not sort of brotherly love. It's not eros. It's not sort of romantic love. It is agape, divine love, a self-sacrifice, a willingness to suffer evil on behalf of the good of the world. And that was what was necessary for every individual in the United States, and eventually the world, to do in order to achieve the promise in the progressive covenant. And that as a political foundation is one that resonated very strongly with lots of folks. And it's one of the reasons why King was so powerful in his message, is that he found something that people really did believe in, and was able to express it in a way that really sort of got them in their guts.
And was this a constant theme throughout his activism, or did it develop over time and he tried different messages and different ones stick and he jettisoned the ones that didn't work, or was it constant?
Well, with all appeals like this, you have to use them until they don't work anymore. And King was very into agape, or love. The beloved community is what he would call the sort of covenanted group. He doesn't use the word covenant too much. That's effectively what it is. What happens after Selma, especially after the Watts riots, is that King has to kind of back off what he means by love, what this foundation is, how it grounds the regime and what policies should be put in place, as well as the actual behavior of people engaging in nonviolent protests. And instead had to start talking tactics, because King was losing ground after the Watts riots, and especially after he denounced the Vietnam War. Lyndon Johnson basically wouldn't answer the phone anymore. So he had to start defending himself against charges from Malcolm X and from Stokely Carmichael. He had to start fighting the Black Power movement as a more radical and potentially more violent response to white supremacy. And so you start to see it sort of take a background, but it still grounds what he has to say, even as he's pulled increasingly. He stretched thin in terms of his resources, but also pulled to a more radical position by the end of the book.
And unfortunately, we couldn't see how that strategy plays out very much, because his life was then cut short right around that period of time. Talk to us a little bit about his media strategies. This is a big impact of your book. So your book has both a very political theory flavor to it, but it also has a more strategic look at how politics actually plays out in the everyday world. What kind of media strategies was Martin Luther King using at the time?
That's right. So for each case, there are actually two chapters. The one that sort of explains the foundation and how it works and what it draws from in sort of American traditions and religious traditions. And the second chapter is more about the politics. And for someone like King, who was the pastor of a well-to-do, especially for African-American populations, church, he nonetheless didn't really have access to mass media that he could use to reach out to folks. But he was very much at the mercy of coverage by the press. This is, of course, after Rosa Parks, and he starts in Montgomery. Well, he doesn't start, but there's the Montgomery pastor starts the Montgomery Improvement Association. Very famously, King is kind of thrown into that job because everyone else has a gripe with someone else, and since he was the new guy, they could all agree on him. The politics among pastors is usually rivaled only by the politics in academia, so he gets thrown into this mix and. He doesn't really know how to get people on his side. So the first thing he has to do is, of course, he has to kind of get his own community on his side. But But what happens is that because of his capacity as a minister, his great speaking ability, he gave the famous Holt Street Baptist Church address immediately after being put in charge of the MIA. He discovered that he actually had a gift in order to draw attention to his position and get people on his side. So if he was going to sort of embody this movement, he was going to be able to draw attention to himself and therefore the suffering of people in Montgomery and across the South, African-American centers. And so the media strategy began with drawing attention to him, and then by drawing attention to him, he would draw attention to the conflict. And this is what he meant by dramatizing the movement. People would see the fights that the police would put up against the nonviolent protests, and these would illustrate what it's like in everyday life for African Americans in Montgomery and Birmingham, Atlanta, and the like. There was constant violence against African Americans that was treated as everyday. And when people sit at home and see it on television, they see it in a different context. And as people at home saw it in television, or they heard about it on the radio, or they saw it in the newspaper, they became increasingly interested in that story. And so mass media became interested in covering it because it meant they sold copy, they got eyes on the screen. And what King had essentially done was turned the interest of these of journalists and editors towards a little fight over buses in Montgomery. And this is remarkable as a media strategy. It's something that we're a little more familiar with and we don't take for granted. But at the time, it's pretty ingenious. And he's obviously adopting a great deal of this from the Satyagraha movement from Gandhi. But King does it in a way that he likes to refer to. He kind of baptizes the brown saint. That's how he refers to it.
Wait, repeat that again. You faded a little bit. Baptizing what?
He baptizes the brown saint. This is how King, it's a little bit of a paraphrase, how King refers to what he does with Gandhi. He essentially says Christ provided the message and Gandhi provided the method.
Aha.
So that's how he understands it. Once he starts to see what worked in India, he understands what can work in Montgomery and later Birmingham.
Now, I have another clarifying question, because as you were talking, you gave me an acronym, and I might have missed it, but just to clarify, you said the MIA? What was that?
Oh, Montgomery Improvement Association.
Okay, Montgomery Improvement Association, and that is basically where all this starts out, right?
Right, that's what forms after in Montgomery after Rosa Parks refuses to move on the bus.
Okay.
It begins the Montgomery bus boycott.
So King is leveraging the media loves dramatic coverages. They, dramatic things that normally don't happen in everyday life. And King uses this to say, actually a lot of this stuff does happen in everyday life. So he leverages that very well. Does he leave a legacy of media strategies and using his political foundation in combination with his media strategy for future leaders? I mean, I'm interested not only in what he did, but what he leaves behind, and are other people picking up on this?
He really does. It's kind of hard to say whether or not something like what Gandhi did could happen anywhere else. When King did it in the United States, however, he also did it in a way that was, it was a little bit more in keeping with how Americans and specifically religious traditions in America have never really imagined it, which is that they would see themselves together as individuals forming a collective group of people, all of whom agree on the basic premise of what it is that they need to do in the world. Rather than agreeing in the sort of everyday voter participation or through civic associations, there was a direct action in politics that was not like the old ways, which is, knocking out windows, right? It's direct action through illustrating one's moral force. And you see people trying to recapture that moment. There was a certain amount of envy and bitterness about King's success. King would show up in places, and it would almost seem at random, and some critics would call him the Laud. Right, or the Laud. I can't really say it right. Because it's, the Laud has shown up. Now we have to all listen to what he has to say. And you start to see a little bit of that resentment. So people like the fact that King can bring folks together, and that's what a lot of people who are engaged in mass movements now, they want that same sense of individuals coming out of their isolation and forming together into a powerful group, but they don't necessarily want that same charismatic leader. But you still see, you still see this effort constantly.
Yeah, that is really interesting. You think about this in a lot of different ways, and even within academia, that somebody gets, does something very spectacular, and then everybody wants to see them. And when they come to a conference presentation at a, APSA conference or something like that, they suck up all the oxygen out of the room for all the other up and coming scholars who have some pretty cool ideas too. So, yeah, no, I hear that. So,
you experience that a lot, Tony? You suck up
all
the room.
Oh, I don't suck up any oxygen. I'm just kind of like a little algae and fungus there. So, anyways, you talked about changing the ways from the old order, and so that gives us a little bit of a prompt here to move backwards in time and then take a look at Fulton Sheen. And so he's an interesting character. Again, not many people might have known Fulton Sheen. I remember Fulton Sheen from growing up, on the television programs and such. So give us, and especially our listeners who are a little bit younger, indication or explanation for who this Fulton Sheen guy was. He was the father of Charlie Sheen, if I'm correct.
That's not correct.
Oh.
You'd be surprised. He was one of those priests who kept his vows very well. Actually, he's being their efforts to canonize Fulton Sheen. He was so good at his vow.
Ah.
The story behind Charlie Sheen is that his father was Martin Sheen, and Martin Sheen was once Martin Estevez. He has a son named Emilio Estevez, who was in the fine film Hot Shots. But Martin Estevez found that he could not get in to many roles. So he saw that there was someone who was getting a lot of press and people liked very much on television, and that was Fulton Sheen. So he changed his name to Martin Sheen, and then the part started rolling in. And Charlie Sheen kept the name, Elio didn't. But Fulton Sheen had a totally different kind of winning from Charlie Sheen. Did you like that? That was a terrible transition.
It's kind of fascinating to think about this linkage. We go from Fulton Sheen to Two and a Half Men and Anger Management, I guess. So I don't know.
They both ended up being on hit shows.
Yeah.
There is that link.
True.
It's kind of hard to, especially after talking about Martin Luther King Jr., he's got a memorial in the mall. I feel a little bad trying to talk up how big of a deal Fulton Sheen is. But Fulton Sheen, if he gets canonized, it's almost like being on the mall, right? But Fulton Sheen was the son of Irish immigrants who moved out to rural Illinois. They lived outside of Peoria, and Peoria was already pretty remote. But he had a longing to come to the big city and to wear the purple. He wanted to be a bishop since a young boy. And he was very rigorous in his studies and managed to go to very prestigious university, the Catholic University of Louvain out in Western Europe. And he did very well there, came over. He was actually assigned by a bishop in Illinois to work a small parish to kind of make sure that he was still sufficiently humble through having all these early successes. But then finally he was just sent to a post in Catholic University of America in D.C. And he did that 95 route up and down during the early 30s, that he would travel between New York City and D.C. to do a lot of speaking. And one of the things about Fulton Sheen that makes him a little bit more complicated to write about in this book is that he was around a long time, like you said. He had a much longer career than King, and especially Falwell, only like 10 years when he was really involved in politics. So, Sheen has kind of three stages. He has the 30s, when he's fighting with Protestants about the war in Spain and over the rise of fascism. He's got the 40s, when he's fighting with people over whether or not the United States should ally with the Soviet Union. And then he has after the 40s, when he does Life is Worth Living, and he's sort of there in the midst of Cold War politics. And that's really when he really comes into his own.
Okay. Well, lead us through these and talk about his religious political foundations and then how he uses a media strategy to express this. So it appears that he starts in the 30s with his concern over fascism. Explain that.
So So he referred to the sort of three abominations. One was the attempt to replace belief in God with belief or faith in the race, right? And that's how he understood Nazism, was they was trying to substitute God for race. And then substitute God for class, and that was communism. And then there was substitute God for war, which was fascism. And he wanted to obliterate all of these by proselytizing directly against them while trying to offer what the traditional alternative was, which was to have faith in God. And in the 30s, this had direct policy implications. It wasn't just the sort of criticism of ideology that was, you know, not terribly uncommon among Catholic priests, but he did so in a way that spoke to politics that was very important because he was on the radio and had a fairly broad reach. The foundation he used in order to make this argument, this sort of faith in God argument, was that Americans have a sense of religious liberty that they value and treasure. And this religious liberty affords them the opportunity to experience the divine or the spiritual good however they wish to have them. He doesn't, you know, it's pretty remarkable. He doesn't usually go after what specifically those things are. Although, you know, as a very well-trained and well-educated Catholic priest, eventually bishop, he knows what specifically he thinks they should be. But he says that there is a problem with pursuing these spiritual goods under the context of religious liberty, and that is there are those who wish to conspire against our liberties. And these are absolute arbitrary foreign powers, like the fascist regimes and the Nazi regimes, especially for him, the communist regime. Now, this should remind you of a narrative, if you study religion or if you know very much about religion. This is actually the old Protestant anti-Catholic narrative, which is that Americans, Protestant here in America, you know, in this country, are, you know, they don't necessarily agree on all the denominational, I mean, they disagree because of different denominations and different beliefs about what are the sacraments and whether you need to have a trained minister or what have you. But they all agreed that there lurked in Rome an absolute arbitrary foreign power that seeks to remove that liberty from you. And this is the experience of the martyrs under, you know, Bloody Mary and the persecutions in France that they've internalized. So Sheen actually takes the old anti-Catholic narrative and applies it to communism and to the other into fascism and Nazism as well. So the foundation rests on a notion of religious liberty that was actually kind of shocking for a lot of Protestants. That here comes this priest talking about religious liberty.
Yeah, I have to, you know, mention he's doing this in the 1930s, right? And this is going to lead me to a question on media strategy. But he's doing this in the 1930s, and that Protestant anti-Catholic narrative was really hitting a fever pitch in the 1890s, 1900. Mm-hmm. You're getting a lot of Catholic immigration from Italy and Germany, parts of Germany at this period of time, some from Ireland as well. And I mean, I remember seeing the pictures of, you know, the bishops coming with these alligator hats that are going to eat your children, and we can't let them have schools. Yeah. This was the time of the Blaine Amendments, and, you know, so, and again, you know, they showed pictures of the Vatican as this thing that's going to replace all your liberties. Now, that seems a long time ago for us, but take us back to Fulton Sheen's time, 1930s. That's only, you know, two, three, maybe four decades away. That's not very long. How does this guy end up getting a radio show? I mean, the Protestant narrative, at least the echoes of it, still must be there about anti-Catholicism. And yet this guy gets a radio show and is able to talk about religious liberty and saying, hey, we all are in this together.
So Fulton Sheen was appearing on radio in the 30s at a time when radio was a brand new technology. So the Catholic Church had actually started to look like in the United States that it was kind of part of this new, this sort of new technological edge. Plus, what you were beginning to experience was a rise in Catholic voting power. You know, like I said, like Al Smith was this Catholic that was very close with Sheen. Sometimes Al Smith would actually crib Sheen's sermons. And so what you would find is that in places where the Democrats had actually been able to assimilate lots of Catholic voters, you know, the Fulton Sheen would actually have a lot of success in persuading people to sort of understand themselves as part of an American tradition rather than outside of it. And there was not much that Protestant opposition could do for him to stop him, because he was so talented at radio addresses. It's really actually it's very informative to listen to his radio addresses in the 30s and to watch Life is Worth Living, because Phil Machine on the radio is calm, and he's speaking directly to you because you're sitting in your room, maybe you're with your family, and he's speaking directly to you about these issues. But on television, it's much more of a sort of Shakespearean drama. So there's a lot of persuasion going on here, but there's also this desire, especially for Catholics, but also other immigrants, to belong in a way that Protestants, traditional Protestants' understanding of America didn't necessarily allow. So by appropriating this anti-Catholic language and making it apply to all religious Americans, he's actually found a way to integrate all of these groups together under the old way of thinking. It's really pretty genius tactic. If you combine that with his raw native capacity to persuade people and to use media effectively, it's really quite remarkable.
And how does his media strategy evolve, in with specific reference to his religious political foundations? Because I can imagine, you know, somebody, you know, going to a radio studio and saying, "Oh, you know, we got this really charismatic Catholic here. Can we get him on the radio?" And yeah, they probably say, "Yeah, yeah, have him say some Catholic things, but you know, don't get anything too controversial. We got a broad audience here." Does he start to, you know, spew anti-communism and people go, "Wow, yeah, this is great," or did they try pulling him off? And then how does he get his television show, and where does that take him?
So there's actually a few things in there. I don't want to go too far off. I used to be referred to as the Mobile Center on Fulton Sheen Studies. when I was doing my dissertation, it was a little embarrassing. But I know a lot about this. So I'll just leave it to this. So one of the things that Fulton Sheen always liked to do is he liked to make sure he engaged in highbrow discussion of the issues he's describing. So he always appeared to be a little separate from the issue, never directly partisan. And the book manuscripts are referred to this as the confessor approach, right? King is very much the sort of radical prophet of Hebrew scriptures, like Amos. He constantly fights, and he's always very much engaged in the attempt to provoke the conscience of the nation. Whereas Fulton Sheen is much more sort of erudite, sometimes forceful. He can really, at the end of a television program, get forceful, but normally he's actually learned. That's how he likes to show himself. What this means then is he's both illustrating that the Catholic Church is not a bunch of illiterates, right? This is one of the things that you would get in Catholic rhetoric. It meant that they had also arrived, but in terms of getting people together, what it would also do is it would prove that there were these things that we could all read, especially the Russians. He was very fond of discussing Russian critiques of communism, so that it didn't seem like sectarian appeal. He would often very frequently cite sort of Protestant sources. He would cite Jewish sources, and his books especially. There would be this emphasis on trying to find some sort of common ground, since we all want religious liberty, since we all want to, you know, go to synagogue and hear our pastor, not just on Sundays and on Wednesdays. We all have an interest in opposing those totalitarian ideologies that wish to take those liberties from us. And that was the message. And actually, one of the things that it's been hard to do, I didn't end up having much success with this, was sort of showing how Fulton Sheen was sort of campaigning against, I wanted to stress, like, I have less evidence for this than I do the other things. But he was very benefited, strangely, by Charles Coughlin, right, who is a contemporary of his, vehement anti-Semite Catholic priest, who was also on the radio, and eventually got pulled off the air because of his anti-Semitism. When I asked about Coughlin, Sheen would always say, "Well, he's more concerned about things on earth, and I'm more concerned about things in heaven." So he kind of benefited by not being Charles Coughlin in a strange way. But the television show, and this is the last thing, I promise, last thing I'll say about the question, the television show was actually a tax write-off.
Ah.
There was a television show, it's a network called DuMont, that no longer exists. They were struggling, and they needed to have a certain amount of hours set aside. The FCC required them to have hours set aside for educational and religious programming. And they thought, well, you know, we'll put this on opposite Milton Berle and the boxing night, because nobody ever watches anything we have when Milton Berle's on. And so they put Life is Worth Living on. Fulton Sheen, it was already a radio star. He goes after them, says that he'll do it. They put him on the air, and then 2 years later, he wins an Emmy. Unfortunately, after the first year, he moves off of Dumont, and Dumont goes under. Yeah, I think he goes to CBS, I want to say. NBC, I've suddenly forgotten. My Fulton Sheen studies wagon needs to pull up somewhere so I can get my sources together. But, yeah, so he actually was originally a tax write-off, became a huge hit. And like I said, won the Emmy in 1952 for Best Television Personality, which is pretty remarkable.
Now, it's a tax write-off for the television broadcaster, not the Catholic Church, right?
No, that's right, a television broadcaster.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah,
yeah, no, I know this because, you know, having grown up in this era that, you know, Sunday mornings or, you know, the time when nobody is watching TV, you would have these really dull Presbyterian talk hours and stuff like that. And I mean, there were regulations that required broadcasters to provide some public service time, and it gives them tax breaks and everything. And but that changes later on, and which leads to, interestingly enough, the rise of the Christian right, which we'll talk about here in a second.
Right,
So yeah, I remember that very well, and he I guess did it well enough to earn an Emmy, which is pretty cool. So
it was 52. You know, there was not else, a lot else on, right?
Yeah,
so, no, 384 channels, but nonetheless, again, the man's got an Emmy. That's not bad for a bishop.
And how does he? You know, we're now in the 50s and into the 60s in his television show now. What kind of legacy does he leave for the future of political activism using your religious foundations?
So the benefit of being the confessor is that you always seem to be above politics. So when he appears on television, he's not perceived as a political person. He did an episode of what was at the time a very famous game show called What's My Line, and they would get these guests on. They would wear blindfolds, and they would have to guess who it is who's speaking. He does the entire thing in French so that he can hopefully sort of throw people off the trail. And he has to be translated, and he's like sort of misleading people in all of his questions. So the host has to keep sort of amending his answers. But the only answer that's not amended is when they ask if he's involved in politics. And he says no. And then nobody disputes that. And now, if a man goes on television afterwards and then speaks for an hour, I mean, for 25 minutes, entirely about why the United States should want to liberate the Russians from the tyranny of communism, it's kind of hard to wrap your brain around.
Mm-hmm. Sounds political.
Sounds political to me. And he was, you know, invited, like I mentioned earlier, he was invited to the White House. He would stand next to people who were running for office. Richard Nixon, when he was vice president under Eisenhower, was always nearby. Earlier in his career, before the 50s, there were lots of New York politicians that liked to be seen with him as well. The idea was that they were sort of standing with the anti-communists, but the message was also that they were standing with the Catholic Church and its opposition to communism. That made it an unusual kind of pairing. But this attempt to achieve that status is actually, I would say, very difficult. And I wonder if it's actually capable. And, you know, we've had politics has now permeated a lot more things than in the 50s. So I wonder if this sort of confessor status is really necessarily possible.
Yeah, it seems it might be difficult because you have people like John Stewart or Colbert trying to be the confessor role, but no, they're political. We kind of identify that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think one of the things, like I mentioned earlier, he was on the cutting edge of technology in the 30s by being on the radio. So by appearing on all of these new media repeatedly, what he was actually benefiting from was low media literacy on the audience. He could actually engage in a lot of on-screen stuff that people just took for granted that was how it should work. So by being on television in 1952, you have a very different set of expectations, if any, from an audience than you do, say, in the 60s. But just leaving aside normative positions that had changed, also just the ability to understand what's going on the screen had improved.
Mm-hmm. Let me finish off with this before we move to Falwell, but you mentioned earlier that Fulton Sheen is in the process of being canonized, or at least he has a following that is trying to get him canonized. How is that progressing, and is there pushback to this? Is he a controversial figure within the Catholic Church, or is this a slam dunk to be a saint at some point in time?
So this became a sort of nightly saga for me last fall as I followed. What I want very badly is for Fulton Sheen to be canonized at or around the same time the book comes out.
Absolutely.
for totally very religious reasons. But Sheen is subject to a certain amount of classic Catholic bishop politics. There's already been a verified miracle that would get him from what's called venerated, which is like first base, the second base, which is beatified. I guess third base is actually home base in that case, because that's fully canonized, I think. It doesn't quite work. But so the move to beatification, the second stage of becoming a saint, was a foregone conclusion when the Bishop of Peoria right now, I suddenly forgot his name, I think it's Jenke, wanted to unearth Fulton Sheen's body and collect what are called first-class relics. So you would start removing finger bones and hearts and eyes. And this kind of practice, even in more traditional American Catholic communities, is usually a little bit of squeamishness.
Yeah. I'm screaming. I am screaming here by that, yeah.
I squeam. I am a Roman Catholic, and this the squeaming over here is very intense. I can't imagine lifting this poor man's grave.
Yeah.
But anyway, so neither actually could Cardinal Dolan. So Cardinal Dolan refuses to do it because there is, in Sheen's will, a request that he remain buried in St. Patrick's Cathedral. So if you take his body, remove first-class relics, and then take them to Peoria, which is what Bishop of Peoria wants, imagine that, then suddenly he's not fully buried under St. Patrick. So Jenke threatened to just shelve the efforts at canonization and say, look, if I can't have it, no one can. And Cardinal Dolan said, fine, well, if you shelve it, we'll take it off the shelf and do it ourselves. So if this sounds like petty, bishop-level politics, it's because it is.
Yeah, I can sense a whole podcast episode on the politics of canonization going on here because, removing the body and all around and how that conflicts with the will and please, okay. Anyways,
it's just terrible.
So we'll leave it lay at that and move on to our last figure here as we move into the twilight of our podcast, and that is Jerry Falwell. And this guy's probably a bit more recognizable to our listeners, given that he is more contemporaneous than Fulton Sheen. But give us the lowdown on this guy, his political, religious foundations, and then how that plays through his media strategy.
So the Falwell political foundation is what I call the Apocalyptic Covenant. And the Apocalyptic Covenant is a sense that that there are stages in history that we can discern from reading Scripture. This is what's called a dispensational premillennialism. And these stages, I don't know them all by heart. I'd have to look at the fine George Marsden book on fundamentalism to get the graph out. But we are what's being called presently the Church Age. And the Church Age is the stage directly prior to the beginning of the end. The rapture, the thousand-year tribulation, then the thousand-year reign, and then the full ascension. These are all what are sort of inferred from various apocalyptic readings of Scripture that were originally found in the Scofield Bible, I think. I want to say that's true. And Falwell has this sense of the coming end. And what he wants to do is he wants to establish in the United States the freedom of religion necessary to provide ministry to all the souls that need saving before the end comes. He has this sense of like Lincoln would put it, the last best hope for the Christian religion was the United States, and this is very much in the context, like with the other two figures, of communism, like the threat of communism, but But Falwell, like, Sheen was always sort of understood communism to be inevitably going to come to an end. King really didn't focus on it very much at all. But for Falwell, there was this sense that sort of apocalyptic doom associated with threats from a nuclear Russia. And this foundation, this notion that we need to preserve all the moral, that we need to preserve all the institutions to allow for religious liberty to then minister to Americans, was put into danger by folks engaging in immoral action. Right? So if we are going to be the last best hope for the Christian religion in the world, we have to have the divine protection necessary in order to do so, which means we need to stop angering God by doing things that are contrary to what he wants us to do. So this means tolerating divorce rates at a high level, but it especially means opposition to a lot of the sexual revolution, things like abortion. This is the Francis Schaeffer influence on Falwell, a very profound influence. Opposition to abortion rights, opposition to increasing recognition and toleration of LGBT questions. So the reason he is so interested in those things is because he sees them as a threat to the one last thing that America can do before the coming end. And he sees all sort of attacks and decline and any sort of issues as part of God's sort of judgment. And this is that sort of sense of Jeremiah that lots of people have to apply, like to apply to Falwell. But it's important to recognize that he sort of used the Jeremiah conventionally, but the scriptures he actually cites when going through this process are not from Jeremiah, they're actually from Nehemiah. Mm-hmm. And he has a different conception of the United States than people normally take for granted based on more easily accessible works of his, like the Fortress Press, Sword of the Lord books that he had that were in paperback and easily accessible.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want me to go into what that is? Or
Just briefly, yeah, if you could.
Yeah. So very briefly, what this is I have an article coming out in Journal of Church and State called the American Nehemiah. That article was inspired by the fact that I went down to the Liberty University archives and read through all the sermons that Falwell would give during the period when he was most active in politics. And when he would talk about American politics, he would talk about Nehemiah. Nehemiah was a secular political figure who was bringing Jews back from exile in Babylon and restoring the walls. And there's this conflict between him and other regional governors who say, why don't you come down? We'll try to come to some kind of consensus, but just don't build the walls of Jerusalem and create a stronghold up there. And Nehemiah's response is, I am doing a great work. Why should I come down to you? And there's a great deal of orthodoxy that Nehemiah then enforces in Jerusalem once the walls are rebuilt. And this is the sense that Falwell has, right? Fundamentalists are returning from exile. They are going to restore the walls of the United States that protect it from harm. That is what God wants us to do. And then we will be a strong city that can defend itself against its enemies, and then consist in doing the great work that God had always wanted us to do. So he is very much participating in the Nehemiah rather than the Jeremiah.
Hmm. And how does this play out in his media strategy? I mean, he's a guy that comes to the fore after television, actually, cable television is starting to come big in the 1970s, and radio channels are starting to really expand, FM radio. How does his media strategy differ from the other two folks? What does he add to the equation?
So, in a way, he has a similar strategy to the other two. Like, Sheen, King, and Falwell all take advantage of cheap paperback press and gaining media coverage. King depends most on this because he has the least in resources. But Falwell, on the contrary, right, he has an empire of media resources at his disposal once he begins to get more involved in politics in the late 1970s. He's the second most listened to fundamentalist preacher on the radio. And as you mentioned before, actually, that was one of the first contexts that a lot of these radio preachers, a lot of the fundamentalists in the South and Midwest had with government, was when they started to experience rather intrusive and unpleasant behavior of FCC regulators. But what really got to him was Francis Schaeffer on the abortion question, and also the sort of despising of Jimmy Carter that a lot of evangelical and fundamentalist Christians had. So what happened is there was a meeting with sort of new right activists with Falwell to form the Moral Majority. But Falwell, before ever forming the Moral Majority, this is like in 1979, was actually already engaging in more political speech about how Americans needed to become more conservative or engage in more conservative activity. This is actually not, there is a sort of meme in academia that Baptists had, or the fundamentalists had completely withdrawn from politics. It's more that they had not decided to participate as aggressively as they had. And they had always been a conservative force, and they were sort of beginning to feel their oats again when conservative outreach went into people like Falwell, but also Pat Robertson. These people had tremendous resources, they had tremendous outreach. But what's most important about the outreach and the media strategy that Falwell had is that it was totally parallel to conventional established media organizations. So they could reach out directly to people in their congregation without having to deal with sort of press criticism or negotiating with newspapers. They could just publish directly to congregants in the hope that they could then bring them into a broader conservative movement and eventually the Republican Party.
And how did this develop? I mean, one of the interesting things about Falwell is that he has a pretty meteoric rise during the late 70s into the 80s, but then fades in the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, there is a lot of literature. If you follow the Falwell literature in political science, like, he's the first one everyone kind of grabs onto. Like, King kind of takes everyone by surprise. Sheen is not really all that treated. And but Falwell is the only one of the three who's actually operating at the same time, like empirical political science is off the ground.
Right.
And so there's all of this interest in Falwell because he appears to be bucking the trend of secularization in America. And there was this anticipation that there would be this massive awakening and that it would have this huge impact on politics that no one had ever anticipated. And as it turns out, the Moral Majority chapters that were very decentralized, run by sort of associate pastors out in various parts, were amateurs and didn't really know how to do political organizing. And their efforts didn't do so well. There were places where they were successful, but they're sort of like, they're not where you would really expect to see this tremendous turnaround, right? So he does really well in Virginia, right? That's a big shocker. But Virginia itself was already going through pretty serious political realignment with the collapse of the Byrd machine. But he has had some successes in Alaska and a handful of other places. But what's important here is a few things. One is, like I mentioned earlier in podcast, Falwell actually violated and then ended the taboo of direct political activity by people of the sort of evangelical or fundamentalist persuasion. And it set an agenda for them that then tied them to a broader political movement. Even if his efforts were not really all that professional, right? It took Ralph Reed and Pat Robertson to really get things going here. What he did is he actually set up the broader conservative movement with the foot soldiers that needed to win elections. Another thing he did that was important was he actually still engaged in an ecumenical outreach that allowed for there to be a certain amount of exchange of ideas among people within these congregations who had not read things like Milton, by people like Milton Friedman before. So you find, like, the Listen America book that is usually the first thing people talk about when they talk about what Falwell did, if not the really atrocious thing he said on 9/11, that the Twin Towers fell because of America's sin. When in Listen America, he talks about Milton Friedman's discussion of capitalism as a good thing, and he talks about the importance of reaching across the denominational line. It's all done in the style of a kind of pastor. If King is more of a prophet, like sort of an Amos figure, and the confessor Sheen, you have a kind of church pastor with Falwell. People imagine Falwell as very strict and vile, but actually, if you watch his him on television, you watch his old-time Gospel Hour episodes, he's very staid and even. And he pokes fun. He's not hardcore. The text in his books tends to be a bit more hardcore. But his whole presentation is of a serene figure. What that allows for him to do is not to buy into the sense that he is this rabid anti-intellectual, anti-gay figure, even though he has some rather strange beliefs about both. But finally, and this is what's most important about the Nehemiah ad, whenever Falwell experienced any kind of persecution, any kind of criticism, he had a built-in way of then defending himself, right? Because Nehemiah, when rebuilding the nation, the walls of Jerusalem, himself experienced criticism from neighboring governor Sanballat, who's the sort of the villain in Nehemiah's account, he could always look to the press as a group of Sanballats. Or he could look to Democratic opposition to the conservative movement as another group of Sanballats. So whenever people operating within the conservative movement as evangelicals saw themselves opposed, they could then say, look, we are doing a great work. Why else would they oppose us?
Some interesting stuff there, and we'll be looking forward to the actual publication of your book so we can read more about this. We're coming to the end of our podcast, and I want to finish up with one question, and it's a question I ask to a lot of my guests, and that is, what did you learn throughout the whole process of this? It's not just, I have the answer and I write the book, but the process of writing the book and finding the answer can oftentimes change how you view the world. What are your reflections on that?
This is, it's unfortunate at the end of the podcast, because actually I would have a lot to say. The first thing I learned is how much I love doing this kind of thing. This was a tremendous amount of fun. It takes a perverse soul, I think, to want to go into archives as much as I did, but it was a tremendous experience. It felt very much like the calling. But more concretely, what I learned was how tremendously improvised political leadership by religious leaders, or probably any religious leaders, tends to be. King is frantically trying to strategize about the Birmingham campaign, alternately from jail and from hospitals and from half-burned-down churches. Fulton Sheen is constantly rehearsing and revising his set pieces that he uses from radio to television, and he's testing them out, and occasionally he doesn't get them quite right. And there's a really funny clip of him online, YouTube, where he realizes he doesn't have enough time to go through the set piece he's using, the sort of thing that he's memorized that he can deploy at will. And he has to shift set pieces in the middle. And so politics, especially this kind of politics we're engaging in, direct appeals through, appealing to elites and mass audiences, requires a great deal of discipline and improvisation, much more than sometimes I think scholars in political science especially tend to appreciate. We look at systematic and structural factors and tend to give them greater weight, because I think they appear in the data more readily than these moments of improvisation.
Yeah, our regression models don't have a factor for improvisation that just expands the standard error, and we hate that all. We'd prefer something very tightly knit, easily measurable, and very obvious causal. So, very interesting insight.
To end on the note that I am opposed to those models, but merely that there may be something else that needs a little bit of that. Exogenous shocks are always there.
Yeah.
That
is true. My guest today has been James Patterson. James, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thanks, Ted.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.